Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens and break it down from a Muslim perspective. On today's show, we'll analyse what might be behind the suspicious murder of an Iranian Sunni imam who was found dead after initially being kidnapped earlier this month in southeastern of the Islamic Republic. So who was Molavi Abdulwahid Righi and why was he killed? This next report will shed some light on this upsetting episode.
An Iranian Sunni cleric was kidnapped and murdered by unknown assailants in early December amid ongoing Western-backed anti-Iran violence across the country. Molavi Abdulwahid Righi was the Friday prayers leader of Imam Hussein Mosque in Khash, a southeastern county in Sistan and Balochistan province. Local forces had been mobilized to find the whereabouts of the cleric, but his dead body was found not long after his disappearance on a roadside with three bullet wounds to the head. Prior to his death, Molavi Righi expressed strong support for the Islamic Republic of Iran and admitted his views earned him death threats. Iranian authorities have issued warnings against enemy plots aimed at destabilizing Sistan and Balochistan, a region home to many Sunni Muslims. Sectarianism is a tried-and-tested tactic used by the West to destroy Muslim countries who fail to submit to Western political hegemony. Iran may be facing the same challenge. Meanwhile, the violence has claimed the lives of dozens of people and members of security forces, while also allowing terrorist attacks across the country.
Well, joining us in the studio today are two esteemed guests. The first is Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, a UK-based Muslim scholar and lecturer who studied inside Iran for many years, and Masood Shajaray, the head of the London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me on the show today. Masood, I'm going to come straight to you on this because you may have met the martyred Maulana a few times in the past. Could you just start off by telling me what your impression was of the man?
Yes, he was well known as a scholar and someone who supports the concept of unity and the Islamic Republic foundation and the leadership. He was receiving a lot of death threats and the pressures from external sources and so forth, but he really was one of those exceptional scholars, Sunni scholars, who was not only believing in it, but was extremely vocal in his support. And in reality, I think we need to understand that this is the position of overwhelming majority of Sunnis within Iran. I was in Qesh last year, and when I went around and I saw the sort of reflection of the unity, you know, there were Shia mosque, Sunni mosque, Adhan, few sort of minutes in different timing. But, you know, people, and when you talk to people, everybody wasn't seeing what the problem is. And Qesh is one of those areas where it's almost 50-50. And people were articulating to me that they intermarried. They really didn't see problem there. The problem seems to be more something is a creation of an image that is created outside by sort of individual sort of agents and those who actually want to create disunity. And we know that divide and rule is one of the things colonials have done and used as effectively over years and years.
Do you think that that's what we're seeing happening now in the south, east of the country? You think that perhaps there's some kind of attempt to divide Sunnis and Shias?
Oh, this has been going on since the beginning of the revolution. I mean, if you look at how many anti-Shia books were before the revolution, you hardly could see it. You know, there was probably one or two. When you look at the Ikhwan al-Muslimin sort of leadership, there was always Shia and Sunni sort of representation, even at that level. But what we are seeing now after the revolution, there were books after books after books being published in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, pumping this sort of idea of these are others, they're not one of us. And I remember in UK, I was running and were involved in running of a mosque. And as everybody knows, I've come from a Shia background. But the mosque was actually a Sunni mosque. And I was the vice president of it in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And we were going around trying to find Qurans from different places. And when we went and approached Central Mosque and other places in London to get some Qurans, we couldn't find Qurans, but they were actually willing to give us tons and tons of books which are sectarian promotion. So really that was happening just very clearly, and you could see it so clearly, and that has continued since then till now, and has become more sophisticated.
For sure. Sheikh Hanif, let me bring you in on this discussion, because again, you've been to Iran. You know perhaps what it's really like there behind the negative headlines which we've seen circulating around. Last episode, we discussed the fact that there are anti-Iran protests going on right now, but it seems like this assassination of a minority religious leader is something different here. What's your impression of what's going on in Iran right now?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I don't think it's different. I think, first of all, it's a natural human tendency to love each other. That's the most powerful tendency, right? People of different ethnic groups, racial groups, religious groups, and so on, living together normally, all right, they will build bridges with each other. The differences or hostility between these groups always come from the outside and always come from people who find, or communities or countries or whatever, or political interests and so forth, that find it important for you to have a division in order to control for their benefit. Okay? As Brother Mahsoud, correctly stated, before the Islamic Revolution, you would hardly find anti-Shia books in the Sunni community. Okay? After the Islamic Revolution, which is calling for the Muslims to overthrow Western imperialist domination, okay, you find a plethora of anti-Shia books in the community, and even anti-Sunni type of things also appearing in the Sunni community by those people who are partners in that project. Okay, so that project is not, it will exploit both sides. Now, when we are talking about the Mahsa Amini thing, all right, it is quite interesting that, first of all, yes, you had this anti-Shia stuff going on and a lot of infiltration into Iran and so on. But you also find it coincides with the Russia-Ukraine war, and the fact that Iran is supporting Russia, you see, in this. And if you see the increased intensity, for example, in places like Pakistan, making almost extortionate demands on countries in Africa and Asia and so forth, to force people to take a side on this, you see this Mahsa Amini thing started to ramp up. Mm. Okay, so I think the assassination of Shahid Rig and the Mahsa Amini thing and the Russia-Ukraine aspect, all of these things are coming together, mm-hmm. And with respect to Iran, they're using classical, I don't know if you'd call it soft power or regime change by stoking what are not really divisions, but could potentially be divisions in a society. For example,
they're
divisions
looking for wiggle room, somewhere to exploit.
Divisions in belief. Male, female type of things, youth, older generation things, right? Mm. All of these things are natural sort of like, not really divisions, but, categories in society, if one could call it that, you see?
And the potential areas to exploit that. Use the economy to their benefit, that type
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly.
Yes, you know? For sure.
So I think, you know, people who are, you know, cognizant of the trends of history would be able to pick that up.
Now, Masoud, before we move on to the next segment, you've got about a minute left or so. I want to ask you, we don't actually know. I think there's been some arrests made, but they're still investigating who conducted this assassination. Could you perhaps give your opinion on who potentially could be behind it? What are the anti-Iran groups that are active at the moment?
Well, really, to pinpoint who did it at the name and the sort of so forth, it is difficult. That's a security forces thing. But it's obvious that those who are threatening him, those who actually want to create this conflict, those who want to create this otherization, that separation, as the brother said, those are the ones behind it. What they seem to be concentrating on is to turn Iran to another Libya, to another Syria. And for that, any division, any conflict is actually is picked up and amplified. And this amplification is also seen more outside, like Syria and Libya, seen more outside than inside. But also, I think what is important for people inside to recognize is that the lives of everyone in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan was shattered through this intervention and conflict creation of the West, and which has served no one except the weapon manufacturers and the State of Israel to For sure. have a conflict in the whole region.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for your opinion so far. We are going to come back to the discussion. But first, let's take a moment to browse through some online opinions and reactions to the shocking and disturbing news of the scholar's assassination. We have a tweet coming here which says, all praise be to Allah and to Muhammad and his blessed family. May God preserve the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is from Abu Muhammad 16, who adds that His Eminence, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, and all of those who are working vigilantly to protect the Islamic Republic, Godspeed to them. We have another tweet coming in from Ashraf as well, who gives a very strong opinion. He makes a very valid point, saying that may his soul be rest in peace. It's tragic how the enemies of Islam and peace despise Muslim unity. Remember, Martin Luther King was supposedly ready to unite with Malcolm X. All of a sudden, there was an assassination attempt, a very valid point, I think, which can be used to compare perhaps what's happening here in Iran. Let's move on to Rahul now, who comes in with another strong opinion, who adds that he makes very, very clear that they should arrest all of these terrorists, do whatever they have to in order to resolve the situation. These terrorists want to turn Iran into another Libya or Syria. And finally, let's move over to an opinion coming in from JJ, again on Twitter, who says, killed by those looking to turn Shia and Sunni against one another for political gain. Just think who would gain from that. Sectarianism is a tried and tested tactic used by Western powers to divide and rule the Muslim world. That's absolutely clear. This next report touches on how and why these tactics have been successful in the past and used to weaken the Ummah so much.
Western colonialists have long sought to drive a wedge between Sunnis and Shias across the Muslim world as a means to divide and weaken the Muslims. And this is also the case in Iran, which has a large minority of Sunni Muslims living within its borders. Sunni Islam and Shia Islam are the two great Islamic orthodoxies which comprise the vast majority of the Muslim Ummah. Sunnis believe that the Prophet's companion, Abu Bakr, Umar and Uthman were his rightful successors, where Shias believe that the Prophet's son-in-law and cousin Ali should have been his heir. At first, the differences between the two Islamic strands were simply political, but they later developed some theological differences too. That said, the commonalities between the two main strands of Islam are far greater than their differences, and Sunnis and Shias have largely coexisted in harmony throughout Islamic history. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has repeatedly emphasized the need for Islamic unity so that the Ummah can successfully revive. He has also repeatedly said that Shias must not harm the sanctities of the Sunnis. But despite this, the imperialists and Takfiris are trying to falsely claim Iran is anti-Sunni, with the ultimate goal of weakening the Islamic Republic.
Well, let's head back to our guest discussion now, and I'm going to bring in Sheikh Hanif once again. Tell me, you was in Iran for many, many years. You know what it's really like there. There seems to be this misconception pushed sometimes that Iran is like this Shia-majority country which is intolerant to its Sunni minority. And I've heard things like there are no Sunni mosques in Tehran, for example. Could you just clarify if that's the case or not?
I have traveled quite extensively in the south of Iran, where a lot of the Sunni population is concentrated. I've also been to Kurdistan, which is quite majority Sunni. And I see on the community level, there is no hostility. There's intermarriage. You know, Sunnis have their own masajid. You know, Shias could come in there and pray. They have their own madrasas, okay, that are independent, you know. And you don't see on the social level any kind of tension, you know. I wouldn't doubt that you would have probably elements that might be sectarian. I think this is something that occurs in religious communities by and large. You know, there might be people who might have these types of tendencies, but you don't. When I was there, they were not dominant as an idea in the community. So I really don't see a problem. You know, the same was like in Iraq, for example. In Iraq, you know, you had Sunnis and Shias getting married and so on. As soon as the Americans want to take over the oil and so forth, then you find a propagation of anti-Sunni, anti-Shia stuff going on in Iraq. Mm-hmm. You know, people who were married, you know, families were broken up and so on. And I think, you know, basically when you find these types of phenomena, you have to ask the question, who has the most to benefit from this? You know, I would always, always go back to basically Western and American interests.
And Masood, I want to ask you again, you know Iran very, very well. Do you think that Iran is perhaps vulnerable to the same type of sectarianism push from the West as, say, other countries in the region have been, like Iraq, for example?
When I went to Qish last year, even I was surprised the level of the unity on the grassroots. I mean, you know, talking to the taxi driver, talking to people around the city, you know, I was so conscious to find out what is really going on that level, because, you know, any other level could be manipulated. And people genuinely were saying we don't have a problem. There are efforts to create these problems, but we are united. We are so sort of almost together, you know, bonded together. But there are elements, you know. I mean, look, in Iraq, what happened, I remember two British soldiers dressed up in Arab clothes were arrested, armed to the teeth with bombs, and they were arrested. What do you think they were doing? You know, if you go to one community and dressed up as that community and bomb the other side, and then next day go to the other community and bomb the opposite side, even if there are people two sides of same street and have no other difference other than that, they start fighting each other because they see people from that side of the street are attacking this side and from this side to that side. So it's easy to create that. And I've been involved. We have a program called Charter 3103, which is from the verses of Quran, at Tasma Bahamdullah Jamian. And we go for conflict resolution. We have done this settings in Pakistan, in Indonesia, in Malaysia. And it's been extremely successful, bringing people from the Salafi background, from Sufi background, from Shia background. And when you put people together over a few days, praying together, eating together, joking together, and so forth, you see the bonding. And, you know, people going through that process usually come back and they say, look, before we used to go to studio of TV studios and we used to really go for each other. Now, we're ashamed of doing that. Mm. We actually cannot go for each other that way because on the level of heart being brought together. And I think the verse is actually deals with that. It's not a political unity. Allah says, unite. And you remember the times that you were separate from one another. Then I brought your hearts together. Mm-hmm. So we mm-hmm. need to unite on the level of heart, on the level of, you know, brotherhood and so forth. And I think the other really important thing is that the creative illusion, and I've seen it. I was giving a talk once, and a brother from a Salafi background got up. He said, what you're saying about unity is fantastic, but it's impossible. Mm. I told him that, well, look, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala orders us to unite. Do you think Allah is joking with us? They're asking us to do something which is impossible? Mm. The impossibility is being put in our brain. It's not the reality.
Wow.
It is possible, and we need to work on it, and we need to get rid of these illusions that the enemy is creating to divide us.
That's a very strong story to end your point on. I'm going to come back to you, Sheikh, on this and ask you about this concept of Islamic unity. I think right now we do live in an age where there does seem to be a divide between Muslim communities on many issues. Sectarianism to a degree perhaps has been partly successful, but do you think that this concept of Islamic unity is possible, and if so, how can we get there?
I don't think it's possible. I think it's natural. It's not just possible, it's natural. I mean, when you look at the history of Islam, okay, you never found a situation. You very rarely would you find a situation where people are forced to convert to Islam, you know, in contradiction to Western propaganda, okay? In fact, what you would find that in the Christian countries, okay, you had more intolerance, okay, than in Muslim countries for other religions, not to mention other Muslim sects or points of view. Okay, so when you look at, for example, classical Spain and Al-Andalus, which was Islamic country, 100% Islamic country, that was close to 800 years, for 800 years. When you look at the golden age in Iraq, you know, you find a confluence of different thought, Christian philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, you know, Pahlavi philosophy and the sciences and so forth. Everybody was free. You found that some of the greatest advances in traditional Jewish thought was under Maimonides, you know, who was living in Islamic Spain and had that freedom to do this.
Yes, that's
okay?
Right.
Okay? Yeah. All right? So when you could have that type of unity with other religions and cultures, you know, what about between Islam, you know, between Muslims, you see? When you look at the Christian world, however, you know, you have things like the 100-year war, you know, between Christians. You know, you had Christians slaughtering each other.
The Dark Ages, you see what I mean? During the Islamic Golden Age, wasn't it?
You know, when they retook Andalus, you know, you had blood flowing in the streets from Jews and Christians. When the Jews were fleeing this persecution, where did they go? Did they go north to Germany? No, man, they went south to Morocco because they knew Muslims would be tolerant towards them. This whole new idea of Muslim intolerance and so forth is actually fomented by these puppets of the West. Saudi Arabia, for example. You know, elements within these countries and so forth. So I think we have to be able to be cognizant of history to be able to understand these things.
Gentlemen, thank you for joining me. Unfortunately, we are out of time. There's so much more we could have discussed, but we'll have to leave it there for the time being. And thank you to everyone at home for joining us for this edition of Eye on Islam. But for now, it's Assalamu Alaikum. ربنا
Rabbana.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
Rabbana, Rabbana, ya Rabbana, ya Rabbana, ya Hayyu, ya Qayyum, nawwir qalbana.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very interesting question. And that question is about, it's a practical question. The question is about what should we do when we encounter a matter that is obscure or doubtful, right? Something that we're not sure about, right? Obviously, this is something, an obscure matter, something we're not sure about. This can be very dangerous. Regarding the danger of this matter, Imam Ali said, "Be on your guard against the obscure matter, for verily it has been set down in order to test people or lead people astray." Right? In this regards, fortunately, we have many hadiths which allude to what we should do when we encounter a matter that we're not sure about. Imam Bakr alayhi salam said, "Stopping in the face of an obscure matter is better than plunging headlong into a disaster." Like, say that, you want to invest your money, you know, with a certain person, right? He's claiming that, you know, he's very good in business, and you know, he just needs some capital. He's asking you to invest money with him, and he promises you that, you know, he will give you a lot of profit, or not promises you, that would be usury, but he says that, you know, he's pretty sure that, you know, it will be successful in this, but you're kind of doubtful. What should you do? It's best thing to do, instead of falling into a disaster, the best thing to do is to just stop and avoid it. Similarly, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, "The most pious of people who stops in the face of an obscure matter," it might not be something related to the world, worldly affairs. It could be something with regards to religion, right? Let's say that you want to do something good, right? But you're not sure about its, you know, whether it's really permissible or not. The best thing to do is stop until you're sure about it. The Prophet said, "Leave that which fills you with doubts for that which does not. Leave that which fills you with doubts for that which does not. For the one who grazes his animals around the protected area risks entering it." Like, say that you want to buy a house, right, and in a certain neighborhood, but you're not, there's two houses available. One of the neighborhoods is, you're pretty sure it's pretty safe. Another area is kind of wealthy, but you're not sure the people there, how they are, you know, and you're kind of scared, if I move there, are the kids there, are they going to have a bad effect on my kids? You know, how is it going to affect their character and behavior, right? So what should you do in this situation? You should abandon, you know, moving to that place which you're kind of not sure about, that you feel doubtful about. You don't know the effects that it would have. Maybe you are sure that, you know, by moving to a certain country, you know, economically you might become more prosperous, but you're not sure about the effect that it would have on your kid's faith or your own faith, right? What should you do? Avoid moving there. You should at least stay in a place where, you know, you are at least more sure that, you know, your faith would be secure there and the faith of your family and your children would be secure there. The Prophet also said, "The lawful is evidently clear. The lawful is evidently clear and the unlawful is evidently clear. And obscurities fall between these two. He who abandons these obscurities is saved from the prohibited things, whereas one who delves into obscurities also ends up committing prohibited acts and falls into disaster whence he knows not." Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at what we should do in the face of obscure matters. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio @irib.ir. ربنا يا ربنا يا حي يا قيوم نور قلبنا.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In a shameful manner, the Zionist movement's major financial and colonial arm, the Jewish National Fund, JNF, long active in taking over Palestinian lands and evicting and expelling Palestinians, is currently suing Palestine solidarity groups in the U.S. for daring to resist its colonial predations against the Palestinian people. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, the JNF, along with American Israelis, brought a lawsuit in 2019 against the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, seeking financial damages over the organization's support for the nonviolent boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, BDS, alleging that its coordinating body, the BDS National Committee, is a friend of terrorist groups. A U.S. federal judge dismissed the suit in 2021 for lack of evidence. However, the JNF argued in court to appeal the decision last month. Equally important is that the JNF lawsuit is seeking compensation from the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights for the latter's support of the Stop the JNF International Campaign protesting the fund's activities, widely considered to be racist and colonial. The JNF case utilizes the 1996 U.S. Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which allows victims of terrorism to seek compensatory damages under an order of restitution in a federal civil court. The JNF was established in 1901 as a financial arm of the Zionist organization ZO, which was founded 4 years earlier to plan for the colonization of Palestine by Jews. In 1899, the ZO created the Jewish Colonial Trust, which in turn set up a subsidiary in Palestine in 1902 named the Anglo-Palestine Bank. In 1908, the JNF established its own subsidiary, the Palestine Land Developed Company, which set out to drive Palestinian peasants off their land by acquiring land from Ottoman authorities and big absentee landlords in Beirut, Damascus, and Cairo. The JNF's main task was to fundraise in Jewish communities for the purpose of taking over the land of the Palestinians, a key activity that continues today. Another JNF subsidiary front called Himanuta has been entrusted in recent years with executing legally questionable land deals in the West Bank. The racist anti-Palestinian colonial policy of the ZO and the JNF led the latter to choose the German Jewish Artur Ropin, already a JNF member, to head its efforts to acquire land in Palestine. Born in Posen, a Polish-majority province under German occupation and a German settler colony, Ropin fancied himself a race scientist and held racialist views of peoples, including Jews and Jewish types. He became central to the Zionist colonization of Palestine. Soon after his arrival in Palestine in 1907, on a JNF-funded trip to explore the Jewish colonization, Rapin wrote to the JNF that he saw the work of the JNF as being similar to that of the Prussian Colonization Commission working in Posen and Western Prussia. The JNF will buy land whenever it is offered by non-Jews and will offer it for resale, either partly or wholly, to Jews. According to new rules, all such lands acquired by confiscating the property of the ethnically cleansed Palestinian people through the law of absentee property in 1950 and the law of the state's property in 1951, over 90% of the total area of the state became legally reserved only for Jews, meaning Jews anywhere in the world and not only Jewish citizens forever. In reality, 92.6% of the total area of the occupied Palestinian territories became reserved for the exclusive use of Jews to lease, live on, or work on. These racist stipulations also apply to Jewish privately owned land inside the state. The JNF continues its efforts today, armed with these Zionist racist laws, including its more recent efforts to expel Palestinians from their own lands and their own homes in occupied East Al-Quds and replace them with Jewish colonies. The irony is that this organization, which has caused and still causes so much pain and suffering for the Palestinian people over the last 120 years, is demanding financial compensation from its own victims and their supporters for resisting its theft of their lands, and their eviction from their homes can only be described as an unrepentant psychopathic sadism.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is Zainab, and today we're going to discuss something very important with Professor Naqavi. Professor Naqavi is a faculty member at Al-Mustafa University. Dear listeners, in this program, we try to answer your questions and issues that you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified progeny. Well, Professor Naqavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Well, Professor, we have often questions from parents, but today we have a question from a teenage girl, and the question is very I must say, a difficult question, but the issue is very, very sensitive. Let me read out the question for you. I am a girl and I am 19 years old. My father has been abusive since my childhood. My mother tries to console me that he is a diabetic and hypertension patient, so don't take things on heart. I have tried to convince myself over the years, but I am concerned about my younger sisters because my father's behavior is the same towards them. And I personally know how difficult it is to tackle with that abusive behavior. Can you help me through your program? How can I change the environment in my home? Though it's a difficult task, but I am hopeful. That's a very, very, I must say, a mature girl, though she is teen, but she is, seems to be very, very mature. And that's a really hard question to answer.
Yes, of course, she's capable, or she's in the age of becoming a mother. She can be married off and she can become a mother, and she should be able to manage her family life in a better way, inshallah. I hope that when she gets married, she's not faced with a similar situation as maybe
her mother was facing.
Of course, number one, in all our difficult situations, we should try to invoke the mercy of Allah Almighty. We should also try to ask the Imams to intercede with the Allah Almighty to help us in this situation and give us strength internally to deal with situations and be patient regarding them. Changing the behavior of an abusive person is a difficult situation. Number one, we need to seek guidance from people who are capable of giving that guidance, counselors or whoever. They may suggest that try to find out the things which cause such behavior. Why does that? What is the thing which stimulates such abusive behavior? What is the reason for such behavior? And maybe it might be so that some of us from the family is causing such a behavior situation for him. Of course, if that abusive behavior is inherent in his nature from the beginning, he's been brought up in such a society, in such a family where abuse is not an issue.
All right.
Then it's a very, very difficult situation, of course. But still...
However, her mother has mentioned a point for her, which she has mentioned in her question, that the father is both diabetic and hypertensive, and it kind of indicates that he takes medicines that are having the side effects.
Yes, so it is possible. And then again, you need to find alternatives to this medication. And there's a lot of medication which may not have such side effects. Managing hypertension or managing, for example, diabetes, it's not just based on medication. You need to change your
lifestyle,
of course. Very important is changing your lifestyle, and you're changing your behavior and your attitude. Of course, that again is a very difficult situation, but still one can endeavor to find ways to, for a child to be able to influence her father is a difficult thing. Maybe she can, or maybe she cannot. If she cannot do it on her own, she needs to find help. She should team up with her mother somehow, or she should take outside help. Maybe she has an uncle or an auntie, the father's siblings, maybe they can help. And they need to sort out some solution for this issue. They need to consult others and find out the causes. And if maybe changing medication, taking your father to a counselor, so many things can happen.
Yeah, indeed. We'll discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi, and we're discussing a very, very sensitive issue of a teenage girl who's 19, almost towards the end of her teens, But facing a very difficult situation where the father is abusive, and now she's concerned about her younger sisters or younger brothers who face the same situation, the abuse from father. Well, the explanation that my mother gives is that don't take things on heart because your father is hypertensive and diabetic. I must say that this mother is also very wise, very mature, who is consoling her or sympathizing her children this way.
Yes, I think that is a very good way. Another way could be that when they, in such a situation, when their father becomes abusive, if not immediately, but they, later on, somehow they should express their love and their respect for their father, and they would try to express their empathy and sympathize with their father. They shouldn't make him feel bad about it. Maybe they should somehow convey to him that, look, we love you, we respect you, but sometimes when you become angry, we feel very distressed. So they should be able to not just, conversation and communication is not just about talking about ideas, it's talking about how to convey what you feel. And maybe the way you express your feelings to your father and you maintain the respect and love that is there, should be there for the father, he may be, feel stressed up, but when he feels that my children are loving me and expressing their respect for me, in any case, he may feel bad about it and he may try to change his behavior. Maybe it's because when he is abusive, they either shout back maybe to show their disrespect, or don't do anything which shows them that their father, that they love him in spite of his abusings. Of course, again, it should not such be in such a way that his abusings are condoned. No.
So the displeasure has to be shown again in a respected manner.
In a respected and loving and caring way, that we empathize with you, we understand you have a problem, we need to help you, we need to assist you.
I understand you're stressed.
Yes, and do you need us to do something? So he may be influenced, or he may, you know, change his attitude, he may change his, he may reflect upon himself and think, look, in spite of all of this, these children or my wife, they are not leaving me on my own, they are trying to assist me, and certainly person.
Maybe the behavior will change.
Will change, yes.
So there are hopes the behavior could change with the attitude you as a teen or you as a wife have towards this abusive father and have towards this abusive husband, I must say. So your attitude basically can change things. I remember one of my cousins at a very early age when we were children, and on Eids and other things, we used to go to each other's house. And what happened next, let me keep it a curiosity for the listeners. I'll tell you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet wasallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. Now let me break the ice and let me tell you what I was saying. So I remember as children on Eids and on other gatherings, we used to get together, have get-togethers. And I remember one of my cousins, whenever her father would get angry, she would tell him, Assalamu alaikum. And all of a sudden, her father would forget all his anger and his anger would turn into a beautiful smile. And that was a beautiful way. That's even suggested in narrations, that if a person is angry, try saying salam to him. Or there are many other things which are suggested, like change your state if you're standing. Can you suggest some?
Yes, of course. As I said, especially when the person, you're talking about the person himself who is...
Yeah, the person, because there might be many fathers who might have the same kind or little kind of behavior, because after all, fathers are stressed. They go out, they have tensions. They can't be humble all the time. So
of course,
there might be definitely some fathers who have such behavior. What do you suggest for them?
They certainly should be able to reflect upon their behavior, and they should be able to manage their feelings and their actions. And someone, if they're not understanding that, then someone should point it out to them. But in a very respectful way, as I said, and of course, instead of, I mean, the child, especially the younger children, a younger girl, because the father is very much attracted to the girl child. He has a very loving, relationship with a girl. And the girl can be very influential upon
father.
The father. They have a very beautiful relationship, and it's upon, she's even, if when you say she's 19 years of age, so she's very mature.
Mature enough.
And she can manage that, and even she can ask her siblings, the younger ones, to help her out, to make, to relieve their father of his stresses.
Yeah.
I mean, take care of his, bring him food, bring him things which he wants, take care, even, for example...
Try not to create an environment in the family wherein your father feels...
stressed up. He should feel relieved. He is feeling stressed up in the office, in the place of work. So when he comes home, the home should be a very, solacing type of environment, soothing for him. I mean, when he comes...
It should not add to his anger, his
children
stress.
Children come to him, they welcome him, he takes them up in his arms, he kisses them. So, I mean, it should be a way he feels lightened up when he comes home. He feels relaxed. He feels, love. Because at the place of work, he's stressed up. Maybe his boss, he's a boss. He's always in a situation with his people, subordinates. Or he's a subordinate of a boss, and he's always at the, the boss is always telling him off or whatever. So, but when someone comes at home, it should be an environment of love and respect and, dignity and expression of feelings and beautiful feelings of love. And especially girls can do that. And that can make him refrain
from all the stresses he has had outside.
Yes. And he may realize then he should be able to abstain from such behavior, which is abusive.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us and for actually answering this very hard question in a very sensible manner. Dear sister, one of the other ways that's just coming into my mind, if you want your father to feel respected and at the same time you're making efforts to change the environment. You said you have siblings. You can actually teach your siblings some of the hadith, some of the narrations about the control of anger very loudly in front of your father. Like you can say, "Dear sister, do you know Imam Qasim was named Qasim because he had control over his anger?" You could say such beautiful things in front of your father and maybe he indirectly understands your message. Thank you so much for being with us. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.